Oh, yes. Good evening and welcome to the August 2019 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. We'll go ahead and call the meeting to order. And our first agenda item will be to offer public comment for any persons desiring to address the Health Commission with issues that are important to us, but not on our agenda for the evening. Do we have any public comment? Seeing no one running up to the dais, we'll go ahead and start with our evening presentations. So this evening, we're going to talk about emergency preparedness, what we have here available in the county and how things come together for us. So we have three speakers. We have Joe Gazzardi, who's from the County of San Luis Obispo Office of Emergency Services. He will be followed by Eric McCurdy from the Personal Emergency Preparedness is what he will address. He's from the American Red Cross. And then bringing up the threesome will be Vince. Oh, I can never say your last name, Vince. Vince from our Public Health Emergency Medical Services Administrator. So we'll go ahead and turn it over to you. Where it says speak.
Where it says speak. How's that? And it says here 3 minutes, so I have to go fast. Okay, hi everybody. I'm Joe Gazzardi with the County Office of Emergency Services. And we're going to talk a little bit about what our office does. And I think that the flavor of the presentation has to do with something called public safety power shutdown, which is otherwise known as a power outage. And I'll explain, see if this works. Okay, good. So there's the three of us. Perucci. Right? If you have a last name like Gazzardi, you can pronounce Perucci. So that's me. And here we go. So public safety power shutdown is something invented by the utility companies in California, PG&E, Edison, and San Diego. What they're going to do, what they've been doing the last couple fire seasons, is when they anticipate high fire conditions, they turn the power off proactively to prevent wildfires from starting. And I'll explain some of the details. This slide is basically from PG&E, the way that they present what we call PSPS is an effort to reduce wildfire risk. They base it on factors that have to do with the weather and the fuel, where the power lines are, fuel, the basically the forested lands. They try to give us advance notice, but they're not promising. And they're telling us that the power could be off for several days in a worst-case scenario. And again, I'll explain a little bit more as we go into this. So red flag warning, that's a term that's used with fire departments. Red flag generally refers to weather conditions of low humidity, high wind, and high temperature. So basically bad fire weather. Again, the dry fuels have to do with the fact that a lot of the power lines go through forested areas. And so when it's windy and dry and it's hot, there's a higher probability that something will happen. A tree will fall into a power line or something will happen that will ignite, and then the fire will take off because of the conditions that exist. This is something that folks confuse a little bit, so that the fire map for the areas is broken up into a couple of tiers, three different tiers. Tier 3 is the extreme, so that's the red on the map. Tier 2 is elevated. And then there isn't a Tier 1, but if there was a Tier 1, that would be like the city, in within the city limits, the areas that aren't forested, don't have brush, don't have trees. So the problem here, though, is that when they turn the power off because of bad fire weather conditions in a Tier 3 or a Tier 2 area, those power lines actually come into the cities. So turning them off in a Tier 3 or a Tier 2 will turn off power here. Even though we may not have bad conditions here in San Luis Obispo, the bad conditions might be over the hill, over in the Central Valley. So they'll turn off the power because of the conditions over there. And unfortunately, the transmission lines sometimes will affect our area. And that's our biggest fear, is that the power will go off somewhere else and it'll affect us here. And then we don't get power back again until they inspect the lines and they've given all clear for the lines that are over in a Tier 3 or a Tier 2. Make sense? So what they're going to try to do, what they're saying they're going to try to do, is give us 48-hour notice. But again, they can't promise that. So we could have notice up to 2 days prior because of the weather predictions. Or something could happen very quickly. Something could manifest within several hours, and we might get notice almost right before they turn the power off. What they promise also is that they're going to tell us when to expect the power going back on. The problem with that is it's difficult to predict, because the only way that they will turn the power back on is after they visually inspect the lines. So they're turning the power off just in case a tree falls into the lines. Naturally, they're not going to turn the power back on unless they go look at all the lines and make sure there's no trees on the lines. And that is mostly what will take the days, is re-inspecting the lines. Because all they have to do is flip a switch, turn it on, off and on. What takes the day or two or three is going back and looking at the lines, visually inspecting them. This is kind of a busy slide, but it basically says what I just said. When the extreme weather is coming, they will determine if they want to turn the power off proactively. Once that weather has passed, they're going to visually inspect the lines. It shows there on the slide anywhere from a day to 2 days. But they're telling us in a worst-case scenario, it could take more than that. And again, these are extremes. These are worst-case scenarios. In the past, they've done this in different areas throughout the state, and it might be a day or so. Might be a day or two. I don't know that we've actually experienced where they've done this for 4 to 7 days. This is something that they're saying could happen, but the probability is not quite there. So for my office, the Office of Emergency Services, we're in charge of planning and preparing for any kind of disaster. But this one would be an extended power outage that might cause a lot of adverse effects to the community. So we're looking at the capabilities that the departments throughout the county have, any gaps that we might have, and strategies to try to fill those gaps. And again, I'll try to explain that in more detail. So we're looking at having emergency power for the departments that need it. So those are the usual suspects: sheriff, fire, public health, public works. Some of the other departments aren't as in dire need of power that the emergency responders are. Going with that, if we have emergency backup power, which is basically known as a generator, we also need fuel. So you can imagine if the power is going to be out for a day or two or three or four or five, there's going to be a lot of folks looking for the same fuel supplies. So we're trying to prepare for that and have fuel for the generators. We're looking to make sure that we have ample communication. When the power goes out, cell phone towers may stop working. They might run out of backup power or backup battery power. The radio repeaters, same thing. Might run it right out. So we're worried about the communication capabilities when the power goes out for an extended period of time. I'll let Vince talk about hospitals and medical issues, but we are looking into that to make sure that we look at their capabilities, their gaps, and then strategies to help them. Public Works deals with water supply and then wastewater, and a lot of those systems rely on power. Some of those systems have backup power, some don't. So we might have some issues with delivering water, and may have some issues in dealing with wastewater. In this day and age, we all rely on electronic files to do our work. The servers and electronic files may not be available if the power is out, so we're planning ahead for that. And then, of course, the food supply. And mainly what we're concerned about in the county when it comes to the food supply is that the jail needs to still operate, and they still need to feed people that are in the jail. So things like that. And then employee staffing is a big issue. If the power goes out, people don't know if they can come to work and do work because the building might not have power. They may not have access to their electronic files. So we're dealing with planning and preparing for staffing so that the county continue operating properly. So when this happens, when the power goes out, if they do it this year due to the climate, we're supposed to get a notification from PG&E. If they do, if we think it's going to extend for a day or two, we will probably activate the Emergency Operations Center so that we can help coordinate our response to what happens. In that EOC, we would find out and provide situation status. So we would gather all the information of everything that's happening in the community when it comes to the power and the impacts. And we provide that information to the county administrator and the Board of Supervisors and to the public through the media. Our job in that EOC is also to support the county departments. So if fire or sheriff or public works or public health are saying, hey, we need help, we have a problem, we would figure out a strategy and try to solve that problem. We also work very closely with the seven cities. So if the cities have issues, we're there to try to find solutions to their problems as well. And again, I mentioned it a minute ago, but we also focus on emergency public information because, as most of you know, when the power goes out, folks generally want to know when's it coming back on. So we're going to try to stay in touch with PG&E and with the status in the field so that we can keep the public informed and not, and I hate to say this, but not leave them in the dark. No pun intended. Our overall goal is to protect life, property, and maintain continuity of operations for the county. So we're focusing on that. And that's why when we're looking at those gaps that we have and strategies to try to solve those gaps, we're looking at the Sheriff's Department. And their big concern is being able to maintain operations in the jail, naturally. County Fire, so that they can respond to emergencies. And again, their big issue would be water and fuel. They can continue operating normally if they have those things. Public Works, again, I mentioned that they power affects their ability to provide water and deal with wastewater. Again, I'll let Vince talk about Public Health, EMS, and Environmental Health Services. They'll be facing big issues as well. So you can imagine if downtown San Luis Obispo has no power for 3 days, what do you think is going to be happening with all the restaurants or the supermarkets? Going to have a lot of food issues. So EHS would be very busy. Our county information technology department is the one that takes care of our servers and our electronic files, so we're going to be working very closely with them to make sure they can maintain a status quo so we can keep the county operating properly. Same thing with human resources, HR. We're going to be looking at them to help us triage whether folks come to work or don't come to work or where they can work if they can't work in the buildings that they're used to working in. So that will be a big issue if we do have power out for days. And then again, we're here to support the cities and the special districts that we partner with so that they can continue to function normally as well. And I think that's it for me. What we're going to do here, I'm going to turn it over to Eric McCurdy, who will then turn it over to Vince. And then at the end, I think the plan was, if you had any questions, then we can address those at the finish. Thanks very much.
So good evening. I'm Eric McCurdy with American Red Cross. And to begin with, emergency preparedness is a very in-depth subject, and I'm not going to be able to go into it in-depth this evening. So I'm going to hit the highlights, and I'm going to refer you to websites. And I know that this meeting is being filmed, so anybody that's watching it is also, I'm encouraging them to go to the websites. Everything I'm going to speak about this evening and much, much more is available on the website. Like I say, I'll hit the highlights, and the websites have the step-by-step how to actually execute the things that I'm talking about this evening. So the reality is that for a large majority of the population, when you ask them what their personal emergency preparedness plan is, It's 911. And this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about preparing for a situation when help is not available, when you need to be on your own. And so we're going to encourage people to get personally prepared. There are two types of situations that the Red Cross encourages people to prepare for. The first would be what we refer to as grab and go, an immediate situation where you must get out right away. And then the other situation is a shelter in place. And I'll talk about each one of these in just a moment. So one example of grab and go, of course, is a house fire. And despite what I just said about 911, of course, 911 is appropriate for a house fire. You do need to evacuate immediately. But I'm going to use this as an example because part of what the Red Cross encourages people to do, it's not just gathering together stuff, which we want everyone to have, but to have a plan. An example of part of a house fire plan, especially if you have children. You can imagine the house is on fire and mom successfully gets out the front door. Child gets out the back door. Mom doesn't know where the child is. There's a potential for mom to re-enter the house to look for the child. So an example of a house fire plan that you want to go over with all the members of the family ahead of time would be just to have a meeting place. To have everybody in the family know that once you get out of the house, you go across the street to the neighbor's mailbox, and everyone goes to the same place. So that child that got out the back door knows to come around to the front and go around to the neighbor's mailbox. And these are the sorts of things, like I said, that are dealt with in greater detail on the website. An evacuation order is also an example of an immediate situation. And evacuation orders are usually preceded by an evacuation warning, of course. And this gives a unique opportunity for you to do some preparation at that time. If anyone is under an evacuation warning, we suggest that you gather together your personal items that are not replaceable, and also very important documents. If you have insurance documents, family photos, things like that, load the car ahead of time, be prepared to go. And then if there's an evacuation warning, to follow that warning and go immediately. They're issued for a reason. They're issued for public safety, and we encourage everyone to follow the guidance of law enforcement in a situation like that. And this is a situation, again, where I'll mention this again later in my presentation, where you want to take your go bag. And a go bag is something that I'll talk about in just a moment that's related to an evacuation situation. Now, there are other situations where you're going to have to shelter in place. And what Joe was referring to, an extended power outage, is an example of one where you need to shelter in place. You need to plan ahead. If there's an extended power outage, for example, how long is the food in your refrigerator going to last? You won't have a lot of things in the house, but you do want to stay in your house. You have all of your resources there, everything except power. There's no reason to leave your house. So you want to have the materials that you need at your house to be able to successfully get through an extended power outage or sometime when outside help is not going to come. The other example, of course, would be an earthquake, or one other example. We experienced a large one, California, very large, 7.1. And in a situation like that, you need to be personally prepared because 911 is not available for you personally because 911 would be significantly overwhelmed. And so they would be doing what's called triage, and they must respond to the most dire situations first. And you may not meet that criteria. So you need to plan for and prepare yourself. So the idea is, again, to plan for a situation when help is not going to come right away. And you need to be prepared to not just deal with yourself, but your entire family. And you need to, we encourage people to draw that circle out, not just for yourself and your family, but your neighborhood, your neighbors. Are there others in the neighborhood who may need your assistance in a situation where they can't reach 911 either? So Red Cross has a program that's been in place for decades. It's called Be Red Cross Ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed. This is what's on our website. Like I said, step-by-step instructions of everything I'm going to mention here is on the website. Our website is pretty easy to remember. Ours is not the only website that has this information. The County of San Luis Obispo has one as well called prepareslow.org. The redcross.org is also, obviously, I'm going to recommend that as a situation. They, both of these websites share the characteristic of answering the question of what is it that you want in your emergency kit. It goes through and it has lists of things that you should purchase, and it has questions to think of ahead of time. For example, if you have canned food, but you have an electric can opener, it's not going to do you much good when there's no electricity. So simple things like that, that reminds you that you should also have, for example, a hand-operated can opener. So the Red Cross has for decades said a household kit has to have everything that you need to survive without assistance for 3 days. But as of late, we've been encouraging extending that to say it's better to have a kit that has supplies for a longer duration. As Joe mentioned, it's a possibility that these electrical outages, for example, can last for longer periods of time, and so you want to be able to survive that longer duration as well. And a go bag is simply a subset of the same items you have in the household kit. Household kit would be all-encompassing, has hopefully everything that you need for that 7 to 10 day period of time. The go bag has a smaller version of it, only for a few days, let's say 3 days. And that's an example of something that you're going to want. If there's an earthquake and your house is not safe to be in, you're going to take your go bag with you so you're not outside with absolutely nothing to help you survive. And again, the website goes into great detail to suggest what things are most important, what things you want in that go bag. You want to make sure that what you've done doesn't just have the basics, but it's applicable to your specific family situation. If you have infants and child or children, young children in the house, you may have diapers to deal with that other households won't. If they're elderly in the house, someone with mobility issues, your plans would be different. Your supplies would be different. So it's if for me, I have an extra pair of glasses in mine. Someone that doesn't wear glasses doesn't have to do that, but I do. So on the website, again, it goes through and we encourage everyone to gather the essentials. The essentials are food, water, first aid kit, any medication that you need, and then what I call the kind of the tools situation. Tools can include, appropriate shoes, and which is a big one that a lot of people don't think about. A lot of people are not always wearing shoes that you want to wear for several days, and especially in a disaster situation. Gloves, battery-operated radios, and I'll say absolutely no candles. We definitely discourage the use of candles for lighting. Obviously, it has a potential bad effect. Radio. Radio is important because during a disaster, there's still communication, and communication is being provided to the community as best as possible, depending on what the disaster is. There are radio stations that have generator backup power. And they'll be providing information that's very, very useful to everyone as a disaster unfolds. Now, we understand that if you look at this list of things we're asking people to buy, it can be very financially daunting, and not everyone has that budget that can just go out and buy a bunch of extra stuff without any impact. So we encourage people, if you're on a budget, what you need to do is to have a list of things that you need and get something every time you go to the grocery store. You buy not only what you needed for the grocery store for that trip, but you buy one thing for your kit, 1 gallon of water, and so on. Every step that you take toward completing that kit is a step in the right direction, is a step that makes you you and your family safer. And, of course, this is not my slide. People don't necessarily need suggestions on how to buy and save money about discount stores and so on. But again, I'm going to go back and focus on the plan for just a moment. It's so important that your plan be something that is related to your specific needs, your family's needs. It's different depending on the ages of your family. If you have children, one of the things about the plan in particular, a child only knows what you've taught them. And so when you're talking about we have a plan, you need to go over the plan with the child. If you're talking about how to evacuate the house, you have to sit down with the child and do that and practice and tell them what to do. Answer the questions. They're not going to be able to problem solve depending on how old they are. I have my 6-year-old grandson in the house, and so my life changed backwards again. So I'm dealing with that and very aware of that personally, as a matter of fact. If you have people in the household that have access and functional needs, someone who has mobility issues of any sort, part of your plan is that that person may need special assistance. Who's going to provide that assistance and how? If there are any other unique medical needs, and I know Vince is going to address that after me as well. And of course, don't forget your pets. Pets are part of the family too. Do not want to omit them from your plan. The other thing about a plan is the plan should have more than one scenario. A plan should cover the time when you're all together at home. And that's a good place to start. But the plan should also have a second scenario that is, what happens if the kids are at school and the parents are at work? You're all separated and you're in different places. So that's a different plan. It's something that you need to talk about. Again, especially with children, they don't have the ability to problem solve. You need to problem solve for them, answer these questions for them. So in going back to my tools section, what I call the tools section, staying informed is very, very important. This slide has an image of a cell phone. We know that cell phones are not always going to work in a disaster. There are any number of ways that can be, they can be compromised or not available. So you need to have something in addition to your cell phone. I love my cell phone, but it's not the only thing that I would use to communicate. The battery-operated and or hand-crank radio, what I mean by that is there are radios where there's a small battery, but you turn a crank to actually charge the battery, and then it'll run for half an hour or so. And when it runs out, you just turn the crank, and it'll operate again. Staying informed, this is the primary way that you'll get information. TV is not going to work, especially because TV is mostly cable at this point. And that's part of that electrical infrastructure that's probably not going to be available to us. The radios, on the other hand, as I mentioned, there are always radio stations, no matter where you are in the country, that are emergency radio stations, and they have generator backup power, and they will be used to provide information, and it's useful information that everyone needs to know. So again, this is the end of my presentation, and I strongly suggest that people look on the websites. There are websites, the federal government has it from FEMA, California Governor's Office of Emergency Services has it, the county has it, and the Red Cross has it. And this subject is covered multiple times. The reason I have multiple references here is it's not bad to look at more than one site. If you learn something new on one site that's not on another, then you're that much better off. So the point is to be as prepared as possible. I'm going to turn it over to Vince, whatever his name is, and then we'll be available for questions. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you, commissioners. My name is Vince Perucci, for the record. I'm the EMS administrator for the County of San Luis Obispo, where I oversee the Emergency Medical Services Division, which consists of EMS, which oversees the daily operations of EMS in the county. We establish policies, protocols, and monitor contracts for our ambulance providers and our firefighter EMTs and paramedics. In addition, I also oversee our Public Health Emergency Preparedness Program, which works with all of our partners, both in the public and private sector, to make sure that they are prepared to respond to disasters. So tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit. I'm going to kind of build off of Eric, and we're going to look at individual medical needs for during a disaster, which is really important. And the reoccurring theme I'm sure you're seeing tonight is preparedness. As we'll talk a little bit about PSPS, the public safety power shutoff, it really is about being prepared beforehand, before the event happens, because once the event happens, you may not have that opportunity or that luxury. So I tried to figure out, okay, how do we talk about somebody that is medically dependent? And it could be any of us, right? Any of us that take medications. It doesn't necessarily have to be somebody that is homebound and, you know, is confined to a bed or some sort of electric mobile device, a wheelchair or something like that. It could be anybody. Many of us take medications. And so I created this slide here that kind of takes a look, and it looks at all the different parts that come into play. So if you see, from family support to social supports to food and water, transportation. And I like to refer to this as a sunny day. This is a normal day. This is what life is for these folks, to be able to handle life, stay at home, and just kind of live life like everyone else. But obviously, things don't always stay sunny. So this is a disaster. A disaster has occurred, or I refer to it as the rainy day. And so you see up there that everything was in green in the previous slide, and now we're red, or most of it's red. And that means that it's offline. We talk about utilities. That's obviously offline. Transportation services, whether you're relying on emergency services, emergency medical services, ambulances, or even just mass transit, it's going to be overwhelmed or completely offline. It won't be accessible. Family support is probably going to be limited because the family themselves are going to be dealing with the same disaster that you're dealing with. Same thing for utilities, faith-based support groups, medical support services, your clinics, urgent care. So again, they're going to be offline. Really the home and community-based services are going to try and hang in there for as long as they can. And same thing is for your personal medications and food and water. But as the event progresses and as time progresses, logically, those are going to also go offline. And so we're going to end up being in a position to where you could end up having literally the only thing that is online are either the general population shelters that are established with Red Cross and through the county, or the hospitals. And either one of those are not great choices for the individual that has a medical need, unless it's a significant medical need that needs immediate medical attention. Going to a shelter is not, it's not optimal, obviously. And going to a hospital that's already going to be overwhelmed with casualties of the incident, again, is not an optimal place for these folks to go. So how do we keep these folks, get them prepared, and keep them in their home, keep them in their four walls? And that, I think that's the big question that we all struggle with. So what I try to do is identify some tips here, and we're going to kind of go through them. But first, in 2000, I found this pretty interesting. So when I was preparing for this presentation, I found a study that was conducted in 2014, and it looked at It's the earthquake in Japan, the Great East earthquake in Japan, as well as Hurricane Katrina. And what they tried to do was look at disasters through the eyes of developed countries. We spend a lot of time looking at undeveloped or developing countries, but developed countries, we obviously have unique issues and circumstances. And so this study tried to take a look at it, a meta-analysis tried to take a look at what happens in a developed country when you have a major disaster happen. And so what they found out was disaster-related stress, obviously. And I think it, you know, makes sense, right, that the disaster itself contributes significantly to the changing of that medical condition. So you have a stable medical condition, somebody with high blood pressure or with coronary artery disease or something like that, and now they have the stress of the disaster, of the earthquake, of the hurricane, of the prolonged power outage, that obviously can exacerbate or worsen their condition. Also, interruption of care, right? We know food, water, obviously could potentially be interrupted. Temperature extremes. Now, fortunately, we live here in beautiful San Luis Obispo, but there are times if you live above the grade, it's obviously hot all the, you know, all summer long. And even down if you live in Pismo in the Five Cities area, then, you know, we have our Indian summer down there. So, you know, you're exposed now to the temperature extremes. Exposure to infection. You're not, you know, those, the sanitary conditions that were once there are no longer there. So it actually, what the study showed was that folks that had very stable medical conditions that were functioning just fine with their regime of medications and healthcare collapsed. And it actually ended up either contributing to worsening their stable condition or even actually ended up resulting in cases of death. And so it's really important that we figure out a way to help these folks because ultimately we want to keep them safe. We also know that we have a rapidly aging population, the baby boomers. And, you know, people are living longer. The progress in medical care is keeping folks alive longer, but it's also making us dependent on our medications. And we just know ultimately chronic disease is increasing. So ultimately, individuals have to take, they have to be proactive and take steps to prepare, particularly, I'm just a strong advocate for this, if you have a medical condition, you owe it to yourself to really take steps to get prepared. So how do you get prepared? Well, advanced prescriptions, that's one of the biggest ones. Now, that poses some unique challenges, right? It's hard, you know, either through your provider with prescriptions or through your insurance company, you're limited to a 30-day supply. How do you get extra medication? That's a conversation you have to have with your provider and with your insurance company because it's good to have, and the recommendations vary, but the best one that I found, and it makes the most sense, again, is that 7 to 14-day extra prescription. So, and having access to it, having it both in your go bag, because you don't know what times something's going to happen, you may not have the ability to prepare for it, but also have it in your residence or at home. So in case, you know, again, you're in a shelter-in-place type situation, then you obviously have an extra stash of medications, or if you have to get your go bag and leave because of a fire or whatever might be going on, again, you have those medications with you. Patient knowledge of medications. This was a really interesting one. I thought back to my days as a paramedic working on a fire engine and on an ambulance and thinking about when I would go into a person's home on just a regular, everyday medical emergency, and they would hand me a list of their medications, and they would be knowledgeable about their medical history. It was really helpful, even though, you know, I was pretty good with my home medications, but there are medications out there that we just don't know. And so when a patient is able to say, oh, well, I'm taking this because of XYZ, and I should be taking it once a night, you know, and once in the morning or whatever it is, that's very helpful. And again, if you end up having to be displaced, if for some reason you should have to end up in a general population shelter, then having that ability to work with the pharmacist there to understand this is why you're taking your medication. The worst thing you can do is say, well, I don't know, this doctor gave me this medicine and I'm not really sure why I'm supposed to be taking it, but I know I'm supposed to take it and I take it and I feel better. You know, that's, and it's this, you know, little oblong, you know, gold pill. Well, you know, I mean, we all have physician desk references, the PDRs, but, you know, good luck trying to figure that one out. So know your patient medications and your regime, your medication regime. In addition, coordination of aid. Again, it's that good old-fashioned knowing your neighbors and knowing your family, obviously, and talking to your family and establishing networks, establishing that out-of-area network or some point of contact to communicate with if there's an emergency. But knowing your neighbors and knowing if there's any vulnerabilities. I have, you know, a next-door neighbor, and she's a little bit older, and my wife and I check on her on a regular basis, you know, and we keep an eye on her. We make sure if we don't, you know, see something poking around in a day or so, we're over there, hey, is everything okay? So, you know, knowing your neighbors, making sure everything's good, and having that ability Local registries. We're very fortunate for living here in San Luis Obispo. Our Office of Emergency Services, or OES, they have a registry through or as part of their Diablo Nuclear Power Plant response plan that folks that have access and functional needs or folks like this can sign up and let them know. So that way, when we do have a disaster, we look at a couple of different lists, we can pull that list and say, hey, you know, did we check on Mary Jane at, 123 Higuera Street? So that way we know for sure that they're being taken care of. Also, PG&E has medical baseline. It has something to do with your PG&E bill, so I'm not an expert on it. But again, it's another registry that someone can be signed up to that, again, allows us at the Emergency Operations Center and those of us that in the response to understand where these folks are so that we can get them help and that they're just not in the shadows, if you will. DME, or durable medical equipment, medical supplies. Again, it's the same concept as we talked about with medications with our pharmaceuticals, is having that same supply, thinking about, okay, what do I have to survive, and having that, again, 7 to 14-day supply on hand and both in your home and in your go bag. Now, kind of like what you've heard tonight, the theme has been public safety power shutoff, or PSPS, and so power outages pose a unique challenge. I know when we sat down and we started planning for this, even just as an individual, which I'll share a story here in a second, we look at all hazards. We spend, our lives in emergency management to say, okay, whether it's, fire, flood, famine, earthquake, we're prepared for it. But one of the things that I've noticed is once we started preparing for a long-term power outage, it poses some very unique challenges. We find ourselves, well, we would use this, communication system, or we would use this. Well, that doesn't work now. So now back to, the drawing board, try and figure something out. And so I can only imagine that we as professionals, if you will, are having these struggles. The individuals at home are definitely having these struggles. And I know personally, when we first started talking about these PSPS late May, early June, I think I was like everyone else. Well, that means I need to get a generator for my home. I live here on the Central Coast. We don't live in ice country, so we don't get ice storms coming through here, knocking out our power for 2 weeks. So that means I need to get a generator. Well, that means I got to have, because I have two kids at home, so I've got to be able to turn on all the lights upstairs and leave them on. I've got to have all the TVs running. I've got to have, my son's PlayStation going. I've got to have everything going. And that starts to feel a little overwhelming of like, wow, I'm going to need a giant generator. But then I take a step back and inventory, what do I really need to have on? And ultimately, it's decided, well, the big thing we need is really just our refrigerator. We have a camp stove, or we're campers. We have, we have the ability, we have a barbecue. We'll survive, but, we don't want to have all of our perishables rot away if it's sitting in, a week with no power. So take that inventory. So folks that are on medically dependent device or electrically dependent medical devices, such as CPAP, such as oxygen concentrators, wheelchairs, scooters, think those things through. Okay, how do I charge this? What steps do I do? And by doing that really down and thorough inventory, you can go from, spending $3,000 for a generator, which is unbelievable, to a couple hundred dollars, which is still expensive, but overall it's much better than spending a couple of thousand dollars on a generator. Power outage kit, having a special power outage kit, making sure that you have a flashlight with extra batteries, making sure that you have extra batteries for your medical devices. Again, doing that inventory now. And then creating a backup power plan, not, having a plan A, plan B, plan C in place, I think is very important, because you're going to rely on plan A. And then when plan A fails, like, well, what do we do? Have a plan B in place. Have a plan C in place. Redundancy is the key. And last, remember, hospitals and fire stations are not designed to supply power. And that's one of the messages that we're really trying to get across to the community, is that, your local fire station, they're great. They're ready to serve the community at 24/7, but they're going to be responding to other emergencies, and they're not going to have the capacity. They have the desire, but the capacity to be able to plug in everyone's cell phones and everyone's, other electrical devices is not what it's designed for, and same thing for our hospitals. So to close out here, the continuum of healthcare, excuse me, You know, hopefully by taking some of these steps, the individual, when you come back and looking at the continuum here, that we are able to change a few more things that were red into green, and then, you know, keep a couple of things that are still in yellow, still kind of wavering there, and ultimately getting more things in green, in green, so that they can survive and you know, ride out the disaster and not be so completely interrupted and impacted by it. So with that, I will close and open the floor to questions.
Okay, so Vince, while you're up there,
yes, ma'am.
Can you just briefly tell us at our last coalition meeting, actually we talked about for if we have a mass disaster of some kind, how we keep track of people who have been sent someplace to know who's in the shelters or who's in French versus Sierra Vista, or who's where?
So we have a system, it's referred to as ReadyNet, which is a web-based system that our paramedics and EMTs use all the time for mass casualty incidents, or MCIs, which really this just becomes a very large MCI. And so the goal would be that when individuals arrive at a hospital, for example, if they arrive at a hospital, they would be entered into this database that we as the county are able to see and see where folks are. We're also building a patient transportation and patient movement plan. The state of California, kind of based upon experiences both from Japan and from Hurricane Katrina, has really worked over the last several years to build a statewide patient movement plan of how we're going to move folks and keep track of them from point A to point B, and theoretically from, you know, somewhere, you know, down in Pismo, down at the pier, that gets, you know, that's where they get injured, and they're shipped all the way to Kansas. And we have this plan in place. So we're actually expanding our capability to address that and build a plan that will, with a really rather simple tracking method, to be able to identify an individual that's injured down on Price Street all the way to Kansas and know exactly where they're at. So when the family says, hey, where is my loved one? We can say, well, we see them here, and they're at, you know, the hospital in Kansas City. Does that answer your question?
Yep, it does. Thank you. All right. Who has questions? Gina, let's start down at your end.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, madam?
I'm good. So I have a question. I think you keep mentioning Japan, but Japan actually have earthquake drills.
Yes.
And the community is very, very aware, and they have volunteers in place. They know their role very well. They know where to go. They know their shelters. And so the community itself kind of handles a short-term, long-term disaster. We don't have that. We don't have a drill. And I've been living in this county for 5 years now and in the same house for more than 4 years. I still don't know if something happens where the shelter is going to be. I don't know where the Red Cross is going to set up their triage. So we don't even know who the volunteers are. Does anybody here signed up as a Red Cross volunteer? So something happened. They are trained, and some of the communities actually, you go Red Cross and you're certified as the emergency volunteer, and they are called on when something like this happens. I haven't seen any of those in this community. So if you can.
Sure. I try to stay just in the medical and health lane, but what you're kind of couple of the questions you're asking are really like CERT program and American Red Cross. So I'm actually going to turn it over to Joe, who can talk a little bit about CERT, which is a community emergency response team, which is kind of the volunteers you're talking about, and then Red Cross as well, or if Eric's going to go first.
So I can't address how things are done in Japan, but I can address your question about the shelters here, the way the American Red Cross does it. The Red Cross has shelter agreements in place in multiple locations, and I'll just use even within the city of San Luis Obispo. We have potentially any number of locations. They're different sizes, and they have different capabilities. We don't predetermine what the shelter location is, because it changes according to what the disaster is. If you have a flood, you need to have your shelter in a different location than if you have a wildfire, and so on. So this is why we have this large inventory to choose from, and we do not predetermine, unfortunately, to address your question. We have to work with whatever is in front of us at that moment.
So I guess that's where the communication comes in, since most of the cell phone tower may be knocked down and, you know, we won't have a communication. How are we going to address, how to tell people to go somewhere?
And that's I'm going to turn that over to Joe, because we choose the location, but Joe, yeah.
So I think I can address a couple of your questions. There's a program that we have statewide. It's a disaster service worker volunteer program. And one example are the ham radio operators. Those folks are disaster service worker volunteers. We have a medical reserve corps where you have doctors and nurses that volunteer during disasters. So we have different ways of filling the gaps that you identify. And if we need volunteers during a disaster, for instance, the ham radio operators are a wonderful resource. So if the communication systems are down, they can come and they can set up a communications net for us. So we would deploy them to specific locations. We could put them at the hospitals. We could put them at shelters. We could put them with the different cities and recreate a communication network with ham radio operators.
I was kind of hoping that, can we be more proactive? I understand we have a lot of sites, right? If we have a number that's never going to go down, or some way that people, if something happens to me, I'm going to be going here, and that place will have information what I need to do. Because, as you know, the transportation in and out of this community is very difficult. Mm-hmm. If some disaster happens, you know, even the EMTs, we are not going to be able to go through that freeway. It's just people's right. Going to just probably die because we won't be able to get to them. I mean, that's just the bottom line. So I think if we can have more proactive way when all the lights are on, all the websites are on, all the cell phones are on, let people know as soon as people moving into the area. Or periodically, every 6 months or so, some way we can actually let people know if something happens. We're not going to have a drill. Like that. Somehow it's right. Just not something we do as our culture. But at least people know this school, this area, this is where you can get bulletin board. So those ham radio operators, possibly they can somehow get to it if they can, and maybe post right. Those information and disseminate that information. Because I think there is some way we have to tell people in advance, not something happen. And
so let me try to address a couple of those again. Every disaster is different, so it's difficult to identify locations ahead of time, specific ones that we will use. We have a database of options, and then depending on where the disaster occurs or what type of disaster it is, then we would, because of those conditions, we would identify locations where we would create shelters, for instance. The system that we have in place in this county is the siren warning systems that are in place, mostly because of Diablo Canyon. We try to advertise. We try to reach out to the community as much as we can with the calendars that we send out and public service announcements to tell folks if they hear the sirens that they're supposed to tune in to the radio and TV stations that they normally would tune into for emergency information. Again, if those are down, then we have a problem, and that's not something that you can you can't solve every problem that might occur during a big widespread disaster. But if that did happen, then we would just go to Plan B or Plan C and set up a new network of communication, set up sandwich boards where people generally congregate, a lot of times shopping centers or places where people would normally go, and you start spreading the word that way on what's happening and where people need to go. So there's varying degrees of having capabilities of doing what we normally do during normal disasters. And then we would have to change and modify our actions if it was a catastrophic disaster. There's really no way to fill all the gaps that might happen in a worst-case scenario until it actually happens, and then we have to face the problem and deal with it. But I can say to you that in this county, it's nice having the siren system, because most folks are educated in knowing that when they hear those, they tune in, look for instructions from the government, and then respond. They can find places to go and respond where help is going to be. And that's about, you know, I come from Santa Barbara County, spent a long time there, where we had disasters every other day, it seems. Some were bad, some cut communications, some destroyed homes, and we had to deal with those as they came at us. And I can remember the shelters that we had, they all moved around. It all depended on what was happening and where it was happening, on where we had our shelters open up. Same thing with communication. We did have power outages. We did have difficulty with communication, and we were able to overcome that. And a lot of times with the ham radio operators, who I think are like the best thing since sliced bread. Those guys do wonderful work when our cell systems, our modern systems, stop working. And that's about the best that I can answer that, your question.
Can I just offer something?
Sure.
I'm a retired county employee, and I actually recall that county workers become emergency response workers. That's part of what they've signed on to do.
Right.
And so in the event of an emergency, your county workers that are probably your neighbors, your friends, will be mobilized to help in an emergency. So they volunteer.
Yes, just to clarify, so they're government workers. All government workers are disaster service workers as well. There's two categories. There's the disaster service worker volunteers, and that's like the ham radio folks. And there's disaster service workers, and those are the government folks. And so we have the ability, the county administrator, if he chose, he could take a county employee during a disaster and then reassign them for the emergency. So if you work in the auditor's office, or if you work in courts, or if you work in information technology, wherever those folks work, if we need them somewhere else to help out, we have the ability to have sort of change their assignment. If I need folks in the emergency operations center during a disaster, they're bound to come and respond and work with us in the EOC if we ask them to. And a lot of folks, they may not realize it when they sign on, but they do sign a piece of paper when you get hired in the county that you understand that you are a disaster service worker under the California Emergency Services Act. Okay. Any other questions that I can answer while I'm up here?
Amy.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have two quick questions. I'm not sure who they're targeted for. So the first question is, when we do have advanced warning programs like reverse 911 can be really helpful. I'm wondering if in this county we have those programs and if they are available in Spanish as well.
Good question. So our office has a software program for alert and warning that's called AlertSense. And what we've been using that for in this county for the last few years is for extreme emergencies. So if we were going to send out an emergency alert system alert or a wireless emergency alert, we've been using AlertSense to make that happen. The Sheriff's Department utilizes something called reverse 911, and they usually use that for extreme emergencies as well. The fire department might ask them to send out an alert to a neighborhood to warn them that we're going to evacuate the neighborhood, and we'll use reverse 911 to do that. What I'm doing with AlertSense, though, in OES is we're expanding that program, and we're going to be marketing that in the coming weeks and months, and we're going to be utilizing that system to notify folks for something that isn't an extreme emergency, but something that's not frivolous, sort of the things in between. And one of those would be PG&E has told us they're going to turn the power off in 48 hours. Get your batteries, get your radios, get your food and your water, and get prepared. We're going to use AlertSense to notify the public for issues like that. AlertSense works very similar to reverse 911. We will capture all the landline telephone numbers and put them into the system. And then we also have to request folks to sign in for the cell phones. That's the one problem with alert and warning systems, is that we need people to join the database. Mm-hmm. We can't just grab it. the way we do the landlines. So we're going to be pushing AlertSense. It's probably going to be called AlertSLO, which is a sort of a nomenclature that that most alert and warning systems use locally. Reverse 911, just a little bit of history. Reverse 911 is a sort of an old-fashioned system that was used way back in the day when everybody had landline telephones. And the sheriff's departments at the dispatch centers were able to grab all those numbers. Reverse 911 is now a software program that is very similar to AlertSense. But after looking at both systems, it looks like AlertSense is a lot more, it's a lot easier to use, it's more capable. And the beauty of, to answer part of your first question, is the beauty of AlertSense is that we can do Spanish as well. Right. It's the only system in place right now that is Spanish ready.
That's great.
Yeah.
And my second question is, with such a high volume of homeless population in this county, how will our homeless population be informed, cared for, and alerted during an emergency?
I'm going to ask one or both of my partners to answer mm-hmm. part of that. It's I worked in Santa Clara County up until January, and we had a homeless coalition that would go out face-to-face outreach into the community to talk to the homeless and get them out of harm's way and into safe places. I honestly don't know if that same kind of system is in place here, and I'm going to see if these guys know the answer to that. You know, if we reach out to homeless.
Go ahead.
The Red Cross doesn't proactively reach out for disasters. We respond to the mm-hmm. disasters. We work as part of the coordinated team with law enforcement, EMS, the county, and all of its various parts, as an example. So the Red Cross in particular is not working directly with the homeless population right now. They do become clients in our general population shelters, but we're not reaching out to them. They have, my personal experience, they have an amazing network among themselves. I don't know how that works, but word passes very, very quickly among that population. I don't know if Vince has anything to offer.
No, I don't really have anything else to add. I know public health has definitely been discussing how to continue outreach to our homeless community. I think it's a good question.
Thank you.
So, Amy, I think some of our local homeless coalitions, like Five Cities and some of those, do some of the outreach also. How coordinated that is, I'm not sure. But, okay. Who else has questions? Susan?
Sure. Okay, my first question, when you talked, the gentleman sitting down, Mr. Gazzardi, when you were talking about San Luis Obispo County being affected by other areas because of the transmission lines that run from here, how big an area are we talking about? Are we talking about Kern County? Or are we talking about Kern and Fresno?
Yeah, so that's another good question. It's an interesting one. PG&E has transmission lines. And we get the impression that we won't know exactly which areas will be without power until they actually start turning off transmission lines in an area that's considered a threatened area. And so the answer is we really won't know until we know. And especially in an area like this where there's fewer lines, they don't have the ability to reroute as much as they do in a large metropolitan area. So if you have outages in Southern California, in the Los Angeles area, the broader metro area, they have the ability to reroute and go around spots. If transmission lines go down, they can redirect. Out here, we're semi-rural. There's fewer options for rerouting. So when they shut down a main transmission line in a high-risk area, we will then find out where it affects, what it affects down the line. And I know that's very vague, and it's frustrating for us as well because it's really not black and white. It's really not clear-cut what will be affected. Sorry that I can't have a better answer for that, but we're just as frustrated.
Okay. Thank you. Another, when you talked about that alert sense, is that still going to work for landlines?
Yes. Alert sense, we will capture, I believe there's a little over 200,000 landlines that we have available in the database. We'll capture those, and then we will be doing marketing to convince folks to sign up for receiving alerts on their cell phone.
Well, I live in Cambria, and we have lots of spots where cell phones don't work.
Right.
And particularly my home doesn't, you know. So a lot of us have to depend on a landline still.
Yeah, and I'm a firm believer in landlines. I'm an old guy, and I will never give up my copper landline.
And that brings, someone else talked about registries of knowing where the senior populations or the disabled populations are. And we were talking about more of the San Luis area. Do we have that for Cambria? Because that's senior populated area. And does somebody have that information as to who's where with
disabled? Well, there's a couple databases that we have. PG&E has given us access to their portal for the medically challenged folks mm-hmm. that are in their database, and I think that goes from elderly to folks that have medical issues. And then we have, because of Diablo Canyon, in the areas that might be affected by Diablo, we have a program where folks can sign up to get assistance. So we have and I don't know the number of folks that are signed up, but we have a very active program that we confirm their participation. We in the calendar that goes out every year, there's a postcard in that, and folks can say, I want help. If something happens, I want help. And then we put them into a database. So we have that, and we have the PG&E one. There's another federal database that Vince can talk to. That will give us more access. I want to emphasize, too, before I turn it over to Vince, that's why we will activate the EOC, because at the EOC, all these decisions, all this work happens. So if we do have access to homeless coalitions, we can help coordinate them in the EOC and have an efficient and practical effort for that topic. And the same thing with the database for the folks that we want to reach out to. We will coordinate all those different pieces in the EOC and make sure that we have a rational response to that. But I'll let Vince talk about the federal system that exists.
Thank you. So there's a federal system. It's called EM Power, and it has all of the Medicare beneficiaries that are actually in the entire Medicare beneficiary system, some 54 million, if I remember off the top of my head. But out of there's those that are dependent upon medical devices, again, ranging from CPAP to wheelchair to home ventilators. And so we're actually working on a process. Napa has used it as well as LA County. They've used it during an emergency or during a disaster. So we're actually internally working through the process right now to where we will be able to, if necessary, grab that list from the feds. We have to formally request it, but then we can get that list, which will then allow us to help cross-reference the other two lists that Joe talked about, the medical baseline as well as the Diablo registry, so at least be able to help identify from there. We also have at Public Health, we have a GIS map of all of our residential care facilities. Of course, we have our hospitals on there and our skilled nursing facilities as well. So we have a pretty robust map there as well. But in addition, you mentioned living in Cambria. Then, you know, if it happened right now, my thoughts would be I would work with the healthcare district as well as the CSD, and they would have a pretty good idea. Just a small community. That's the advantages. We have disadvantages sometimes living in a small community, but the advantage is we know our neighbors, and so we can call the CSD or the healthcare district and you know help use them to help some reach out to these folks.
So I have another question around the use of an oxygenator in CPAP, because I know we ran into issues that if you weren't using enough oxygen, they came by and took everybody's big tank.
Yeah.
So now you only have the little one that you have to fill on the oxygenator.
Right.
So, so what's the deal there? Is there any kind of push to allow them to let people have a bigger one, or are you, is our best bet to get a generator if we have to depend on that?
I think the first and foremost would be to try and work with the DME provider, so the vendor who provided the oxygen concentrator. I know it's sometimes challenging. So that would be my first suggestion, is to try and work with them to see what options they would be able to provide you. And then if that doesn't work, then I would definitely recommend trying to look for a small generator that would continue powering that concentrator.
Okay. Another thing that, just some ideas that I didn't hear mentioned, because one of the things I found, I do have a cell phone, and then we're so used to putting everybody's numbers into it. When your cell phone goes dead, you don't have anybody's numbers at hand anymore. And just to remind people to have those written down somewhere, because it's like our cell phones have become our brains. And also banks and ATMs and gas stations. That could create a big clog.
Yes, so that's actually one of the things that I know OAS has been leading the effort on, is that outreach and working with people and knowing, you know, that's why I know within the Red Cross, be ready or be prepared is always have, you know, a little bit of cash around, because you never know. You're not going to be able to have access to an ATM, for example. The same thing for gas, you know, never letting your tank get down to an E, which we're all guilty of. I mean, that definitely would pose some challenges. Want to elaborate, Joe?
Yeah, I just want to touch base on the cell phone thing, because my wife and I just had this conversation yesterday. We bought all new phones. Her phone was still good, so we kept it. It's a spare. And she read somewhere that it still has a lot of information in it, even if it doesn't have a cell service. So I just double-checked. I put mine on airplane mode. You can still see all the phone numbers in your contact without cell service. If you have music on there, you can still hear the music. There's a lot of things on here that are still usable, even if you don't have an account or a cell service. So don't forget that you can test it out yourself. Put it on airplane mode, and you can see all the things that are still there.
Your six-year-old grandchildren will connect.
Yeah. I just found this out yesterday for the first time from my wife, who refused to take the iPhone because she wanted her old flip phone. Back with the others, yeah, we're very concerned about if you play it out that we're out of power for 4, 5, 6, 7 days, it could be catastrophic. Because of the ATMs being down and all the businesses being closed, and then the food suppliers and the gas stations. And so not trying to scare anyone, I think the state of California would probably do something about the situation before it got too catastrophic. But we are planning ahead. We're trying to at least get as many ducks in a row as we can so that we can eliminate much of the inconvenience that will happen if we are without power for an extended period of time.
Well, I, from my own experience in Cambria, 10 years at the local grocery store, and we had a lot of evenings where the lights go out up there because of the fallen trees. And, you know, we used to have an old crank register and we could continue. But nowadays everybody uses debit cards and they're not going to be able to use the cash registers. And I'm going to tell you, as soon as that storm hits, everybody shows up at the grocery store.
Right.
And once the power's out, they can't sell them anything. In fact, you can't see to get into the store. And
we're trying to brainstorm and plan ahead.
Yeah.
So we're doing the best we can.
Find right old now. Crank registers. Thanks.
Any other questions?
I have a quick question. So, you know, I really think that when we have a major disaster, it's not something that's going to happen here locally. It'll be something that's going to affect a greater area of California, like San Andreas Fault, mm-hmm. things like that. So I have a fear that most of the state resource, as well as Red Cross resource, will go to those population-rich area, San Francisco, that area. it's not going to come to us, and I fear that we're going to be on our own for a very long time. So I think we have to do whatever we can do to be self-sufficient. Yeah, like you said, we are in a rural area. So that's what I really fear. Yeah. Another thing is schools. In ideal world, earthquake, this kind of disaster, wait until when family's all together and, you know, we are at home and we all prepare, right? It's just perfect time when they hit. But that's not the case. It could hit any time, and it could be times when children are not at school and they are separated from their family. Now, are our schools prepared to hold the children for a while, because we don't know when the parents can come back to them, right? Mm-hmm. The water, some food. Do we have something like that prepared in our school system?
I can even answer that, Gina. Yeah, our schools do all have an earthquake plan, and they educate on it several times a year, actually. How long they can keep the kids, who, you know, how they help the kids get in touch with their family and that. I actually think our schools are quite well prepared in this area.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Water.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. I agree.
Well, we used to live in San Francisco, so... And even the ATM machine, when we had the Loma Prieta or whatever it was, Ken actually, one of his clients was Bank of America, and the ATM machines, and they have emergency services within the organization itself.
Yes.
That make accommodations and whatever. Communication will be important to know how to do that. But they all have plans, you know, not only how to protect their money, but how to get the money to the people as well. So.
Yeah, the county, we're concerned about continuity of operations, mm-hmm. for county government, and corporations are no different. They want to be up and running as quickly as possible, too. So they have a financial incentive to make sure that, mm-hmm. things work. So there's folks working behind the scenes with all those corporations as well.
So obviously communication becomes very important in a disaster. So who's the communication guru? Who's, we don't want to call 911. We don't want to call the sheriff's department because they're going to be overwhelmed as well. So who do people call if they can call?
Well, there's a... So it's sort of a stepping stone process, right?
We do the radio thing first, right?
If we can, we'll use the sirens. Mm-hmm. And the sirens, everyone's taught to go tune into the radio stations that you would normally tune into for emergency information. If that's not working, then we need to get out the word in a different way. And that's, we will activate the OC, we'll assemble some teams, and we'll start putting up sandwich boards where people assemble, and we'll start communicating with people that way. We'll mobilize the ham radio operators and set up a communication net. So we're talking, you know, dire straits. We're going to start from scratch and start creating a communication network so that we can talk to the community. And it works. I've worked through many disasters in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. The sandwich board thing works really well. I was in a fire in Ojai years ago, and we set up sandwich boards, and everyone got all the information they needed coming to the supermarket and seeing that. And the same thing with the ham radio operators have been part of helping them set up a net. They can create a fully operative communication network with all those volunteers that are chomped. They're bored usually. They want to go do something like, mm-hmm. that.
And you know, those sandwich boards at Northridge, Karma was at Northridge for that earthquake, and they used those a lot all over campus and all over the community where the students lived, and that, like at the mall and at the fire stations and everywhere.
Yeah, they're very useful.
It seems like an old way of communicating, yep. but it really does work.
Yeah, watch an old Western or an old movie, and you'll see where, you know, they post the information on the sheriff's, on the wall of the sheriff's office. Yeah, same idea. We just go back to the basics. And then hopefully if the copper phone lines work, we can still communicate that way. Word will get out. It'll just be difficult. It'll be inconvenient. Our biggest concern is public safety, though. So fire, and sheriff and EMS. We're focusing on making sure that we can provide basic health and safety assistance. And then beyond that, it's inconvenient.
Sure.
If you're without power and you can't watch TV or use your computer, that's more of an inconvenience. We care more about life safety.
Okay. Well, thank all three of you for being here this evening. It was very interesting.
Thank you.
I'm glad to hear that we are actually quite well prepared here in our county, and we'll be looking for that. And I know that the Medical Reserve Corps, they're having a training coming up this fall sometime, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, I'm not 100% positive.
And if any of you want to sign up to be part of that, why, we can get you the name of Denise and who you need to call to be part of that. Susan, did you have one more thing?
Yeah, I do have a question. Do they have the CERT trainings in most communities that we could encourage people to sign up for?
Yeah, CERT does exist. I know it exists locally. I don't know what the robustness is of it, but I do know it exists. And as we talked about, Medical Reserve Corps, which is made up of both medical and non-medical volunteers, they could be able to help out, you know, even at a casualty collection point, for example, in Cambria if necessary.
So. Right. I knew they were active in Cambria, and I have to check and see if they still are. And we have a lot of retired people from the medical field in our county, and I don't know if there's any outreach to them at all.
There is, we have a pretty robust Medical Reserve Corps. There's actually two systems. There's the Medical Reserve Corps, which are people that have, you know, formally identified themselves that, hey, I want to volunteer during a disaster. We do trainings with them a couple of times a year, that kind of thing. And then there's also DHV, or Disaster Healthcare Volunteers, which is literally just somebody that says, hey, I don't know if I really want to help, but I'm going to put my name in a database and call me when it happens, and if I'm available, I'll go help. And so there's really even a further database that we could pull from. And we also have mutual aid. We have a very robust mutual aid system here in the state of California, which fire, law, EMS, public health, included in EMS, and public works, which we rely on. We rely on with our neighbors and support our neighbors. We've used it many times to support Santa Barbara. We've sent ambulance strike teams down to and environmental health personnel down to Santa Barbara. We've sent environmental health personnel to Santa Rosa last year during the fires, as well as San Bernardino during the Waterman shooting, during the terrorist incident down in San Bernardino a few years ago. So that system works very well, and it's tested on a regular basis.
Good. Okay. One more. Go ahead, Bob. I forgot you had your hand up. I passed right by you.
I had a long list of questions, but they've all been asked and answered pretty completely.
Well, that's good.
But I'm wondering, and I'd like to, if any of the three of you would like to answer this, what's next item on your wish list for county support that we could help you advocate for? Because that's what we're here for, really.
That's a million-dollar question right there on our wish list. I think it's continuously, we've seen a lot of really good support from administration on this one, from the administration office, from the CAO's office, and I think that's been extremely helpful. I know from our perspective in the medical and health planning arena that our CAO, Wade Horton, has tremendously shown a lot of leadership in this, and I think that's really helpful when administration says, hey, this is a problem, we want you guys to fix it and address it and be proactive in it. So I think just continually doing what our county administration and leadership is already doing, to be completely honest with you, I think it's fantastic. And if that can continue, as somebody who's been in emergency management for almost 10 years, that's quite helpful.
Well, that's reassuring. Thanks.
Good. Okay. Thank you again. Thank you. So I just realized Penny's not doing a report this evening, Teresa? Oh, okay. So we won't have a health officer's report this evening. We'll move on to commissioner updates. Susan, would you like to start?
Right now, there's been some of the homeless money through the Homeless Services Oversight Committee. There's a little more money trickling down from the state for continuum of care, which is interesting because that's kind of where everybody's speaking to each other and really trying to have that continuum of care so we know which other resources are out there for the homeless as they come in. And they probably, and then they have their own network. So I think they're very well set up other than keeping their cell phones active. I think the homeless are often better at surviving with very few things, including a house and electricity, than most of us are, and running water. So anyway, that's what's going on right now, is we're kind of in the middle of some really fast-track grant cycles. And I'll have more next month.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
The Tobacco Control Commission is working with a number of local government agencies to who are now interested in updating their tobacco control policies. And I believe our county tobacco control folks are planning to present to us next month, sort of update us. It's moving pretty fast, and the neat thing is most of the motion is happening at grassroots level. The dust is still happening. The last Coastal Commission meeting, I'm sure everybody saw the articles in the paper about that. The commission, I don't know, we could all put our own interpretation on this, but they nominally gave state parks a year to clean up their act. I have no idea what sort of teeth are in that. And the Air Pollution Control District Board does not meet again until September 25th. So I probably won't have an update from them until November.
Okay, well, thank you for keeping on top of that for us. Gina?
I don't have anything to report this time.
Lisa?
I don't have a report at this time.
Amy?
I do not have a report at this time. I was unable to go to the Heal Slow
I know it's
Healthy Communities meeting.
Catherine?
I can report on the Children's Oral Health Coalition. Excuse me. At the last meeting, we had a presentation by Dr. Don Tran on the virtual dental home project that they've initiated. He's one of the few dentists in the county who's available, and they made a fantastic presentation. I hope they can come to visit us sometime, and it was quite informative.
There was not too long ago on one of the evening news programs,
right?
Also, I think a child up in the Tascadero was helped or whatever.
That's yes.
Nice to see that. And you guys, I'm sure, were instrumental in getting that put together.
Well, yes, we'll take the credit.
There you go.
Thank you.
Jean.
I attended two meetings. The Commission on Aging met July the 19th, and there was a speaker from the Paso Robles Senior Center, and her presentation was about happy, healthy seniors, a model, and they have a good model of a senior center. And then they were talking about redoing the bylaws to really try to make our community a more senior-friendly community. So by looking at our bylaws, and then Barry Johnson said that all of us should be aware that we can go online in Sacramento and look at the legislative reports. There is a master plan on aging, so we could look there. The other meeting that I attended was the Adult Services Policy Council, and there was a presentation about family services from Tima, and they were talking about, you know, things that we can do in our community to be more supportive. We also gave some reports as far as this one. I think is something everybody in the community should know. There was a report, IHSS. They're not going to be able to use a the traditional way of billing. So if you have any care providers, they need to get on boards. They need to talk with people so that they can get paid. You can call the offices, IHSS, so that you can get the kind of service that they need and get the care providers
paid. And IHSS is in-home health services, right?
Yeah, so there's all these people in our communities out there that are getting extra services through our community, and if we don't help them get this timesheet in place, then they're not going to be able to get the services. So that's a good thing to make sure everybody knows in the community. And then advanced health care planning, we're having some meetings. We met on July the 26th. There's going to be another meeting at French Hospital on August the 20th from 3 to 4 p.m. So if anybody's interested in advanced health care planning, please join us at the meeting.
That's it. Okay, thank you. And my committees have all taken a hiatus for the most part during the summer. I'm sure we're going to be gearing up again. Although there will be just upcoming Heal Slow meets in October. It will be at French Hospital at the Pavilion, this meeting. And the topic for discussion is our healthcare workforce in our county. So that should be interesting for all of us. Do we have any committee reports? Budget? Probably not. Legislative? Amy, anything? Community education? Tamar and Candace are doing that, and neither's here, and I don't think we have anything that needs to be addressed by a nominating committee. Hey, hooray! We have enough commissioners now. All right, we have a one action item tonight, and that's the approval of the of our meeting minutes for our last two meetings, our June 10th one. They were sent out to everyone. Anybody have any additions or corrections on those? I will entertain a motion to accept the those minutes then. Amy is shaking her head.
Second.
Okay.
Second.
Bob seconds. All those in favor? Aye. Okay. The next meeting was our planning meeting on July the 8th. Those have gone out as well. Any additions or corrections for that one?
They look very good, Teresa.
Yeah, that was a busy meeting, Teresa. Good job. Okay, I will entertain a motion to accept those as well. Bob makes that motion.
Yes.
Second. Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Prospective meeting items or future items. So next month, we will have Tobacco Coalition here to update us on what's going on with tobacco and vaping and everything else. We'll also have a bit of a special presentation next month. I've invited, up in the Paso Robles High School, we have a national award winner in the Skills USA competition, and it's their health professions class. So I've invited them to come and do their little presentation for us. So I think that will be exciting for all of us. And we have their instructor in the audience this evening. She'll be bringing them. Thanks, Shelby, for being here. Anybody else have anything for this evening? No? With that, I think we will be adjourned for the evening. Thank you all.